Welcome to Crosstalk, the finest recovery podcast that you can find any place on the face of the earth. We've done a poll. I've said this before, but I kind of like saying it. We've talked to everyone who's ever been in recovery, and they say this is the place to find out how to live happy and inspired one day at a time without alcohol and drugs. And so I'm going to ask you to do something first before we start. I want you to subscribe. We like when you subscribe. We know who's watching us. Hit that bell. Hit that bell. And give us your comments and like us. The reason we want your comments is so we want to know what you want more of, what you're liking, and what suggestions you have for us. Today, we have a terrific interview. Somebody who I've known for several years in my recovery, who's been a great friend. And he's a special guy known by many, many people in the recovery world as someone whose hand is always out to help the other guy and the other lady. I'd like to introduce you to my friend, Trey L. Trey, welcome.
Thanks, Corey. Trey Laird for those following at home.
Trey Laird. Yeah. We'll use the Laird.
Yeah.
Okay. Welcome. One of the reasons we're doing Crosstalk is to try to stamp out, to get rid of stigma. And in the old days, when AA started, people shared their story, and it was under the kind of the shadow of anonymity. And there's nothing wrong with people being anonymous if that's what they want. I don't have any interest in that. I'm glad to hear that you don't. One of the reasons we're doing our podcast is to bring into the light of day and get rid of stigma the fact that there are recovery journeys out there that are possible. If we share our journeys with other people, we can help other people stay sober and get sober. And, you know, if we enlighten anybody today by our conversation, that's exactly what we're trying to do.
No, I totally agree. It's a good place to start. I'll share a story related to anonymity, which was when I was going back to work after treatment. I'd been away for 33 days. I was 37 years old. I was working at an investment bank trading stocks here in the city. And I wasn't sure what I was going to say to people, to my colleagues, when I got back. And I talked it over with some people that had some good ideas. And they said to me, Trey, the more people that know that you don't drink or take drugs, the less people you have to drink and take drugs with. And that made sense to me. So I went back to work, and in that first morning meeting, and I worked on a trading desk, so we had a morning meeting, 25, 35 people, and I, at the end of the meeting, I said, if I could just have a minute, I just wanted to say I'm really happy to be back. I was away getting treated for addiction to pain medications and other things, and while I was away, I realized how much I love working here, how much this crew is important to me. And I'm really excited to be back. If anybody has any questions, stop by my desk. You know, you all know where I sit. And afterwards, the meeting went back to my desk. And shortly thereafter, a colleague came up and just said, hey, that was really awesome, really powerful. You know, my husband struggled for many years, and I wish he could be as comfortable as you are. And then another guy who sat like three seats down from me came over and he said, Trey, that was awesome. I've been in recovery 5 years. I go to meetings every day. If you ever want to just grab lunch, grab coffee, pull me off the desk, go in a conference room and talk, you know where I sit. And with that, I had, you know, immediate support right there at work. And I shudder to think what would have happened if I hadn't said those things. I would never have built those relationships. And I have found over the years, not only has being transparent and open about my recovery been helpful for me because people know that I don't drink, and so it's never an issue, but it's also over the years given me incredible opportunity to help. And I get lots of phone calls, people saying, hey, I remember you don't drink, or I know you went through that time, and you know, my friend is struggling, my wife is struggling, my kid is struggling. Do you have any suggestions? And that's gold. So
that's great. I mean, I like that. And I try to incorporate that type of thing in my own. I'll go to a doctor's office, and it's a complete non sequitur, but I'm just, and you know what? The nurse says, my husband, my son, my father, there's always somebody, and it connects us. At the end of our interview, I'm going to ask you to give us a quote that we're going to put on our crosstalkofficial.com website. And I love what you just said, because it reminds me of the one quote that I put on under my picture, which is transparency. Transparency, what is it? Yeah, transparency can transform lives. Mm. Suit up, show up, and dare to be seen. And by being seen, people connect with us. Everybody who's trying to be perfect and trying to give the impression that they are in some way the only person on the earth who's never done anything that's right. not perfect, they don't connect with people. Everybody's looking and kind of staying away. The more warts you have, I think the better it is. Not that you have to be in active addiction to be popular. That's not what I'm saying. But if you share the stuff that you've gone through, it helps other people, helps you, you know, feel like yourself. I love that. And I love what you did at the job. That's very courageous, too.
Yeah, no, we're aligned there. And when you talk about vulnerability, it reminds me what attracted me to Alcoholics Anonymous when I first went there. Because I lived in a world of Wall Street, you know, go meet after the day was over, markets closed, go to the bar, you walk in, you say, you know, hey, Petey, hey, Maddie, hey, Joe. And, you know, you just start talking at each other about how, you know, what a big trade you did, or, you know, what a great thing that you had accomplished in that day. And you never listened. I never listened to what the other guy was saying. You never walked in and heard a guy say, yeah, man, I'm really struggling in my marriage. I'm really struggling with my son, right? And that, walking into AA and hearing that from the first time, it was like my neck snapped off. Like, I can't believe the language I'm hearing here, but it was appealing to me. It was really appealing. And it's, frankly, it's one of the reasons that I stuck around, because I was so drawn to that vulnerability and that honesty. So, yeah, that's probably, you know, one of the best things about recovery, is getting to know people for real. Right?
Yep. I couldn't agree with you more. It's, I think, in some ways, something that we search for from the beginning. And depending on how you grew up, I grew up in a household, loving household, but you know, I think you're interviewing me. But it was like, make sure everything looks good to the neighbors. You know, you don't share any of that stuff with anybody. You keep it here. That, I don't know who taught them to do that, but I'm glad I unlearned that.
Yeah, I know for sure. And going to upbringing, right? I grew up in New Canaan, Connecticut. My mom and dad split up when I was 8, and dad moved to the city. Mom ended up moving to Sweden, and I had a sister. Have a sister, and so we started this life of, like, you know, traveling to see mom and going back to see dad, and lots of international flights. And ultimately landed in here in Manhattan, went to seventh grade through high school in the city. My dad had remarried. I had two younger brothers. And, you know, the city in 1983 through 89 was an interesting place for a young kid. I lived in the village. I went to school on the Upper West Side at Trinity. And so I had a lot of independence for a 14, 15, 16-year-old kid. Not that that led to my use, but what it led to was my feeling like I could get away with things, and that I might not have as much parental guidance as others. Not that I minded it at that time, because for me it meant more independence. But looking back, I think that that was something that, you know, set me on the trajectory that ultimately had me, you know, more than curious about drugs and alcohol. There's no addiction in my family, although there is mental health issues in my family. So I think I'm also genetically predisposed to having addiction or other mental health issues. But my childhood was great. You know, I played a lot of sports. I had a lot of friends. And other than, you know, mom and dad splitting up and having to move a few times, I would have told you that I had a pleasant upbringing. My teammates were really important to me.
Teammates as in fellow students, yep, that were on the different sports teams.
Exactly. Because I had less parental oversight, I took a lot of guidance and solace in being part of the team, right? I likely had my first drink with one of those teams. I didn't drink because I felt like that was something I was really wanting to do, but the team was getting together and, you know, getting some beers, and I was going to participate because I was part of the team. If they had suggested making sandcastles, I would have done that too, right? So I was a good athlete, and I ended up going to college to play sports. However, when I got to college, I was quickly realized I was not the star athlete that I was in high school. I was run of the mill, you know, back of the bench a little bit. And so after a year, I quit.
How far away did you go to college?
I went to Dartmouth up in New Hampshire. Okay. I didn't really love New York City, so I wanted to be in a rural environment. And so I only looked at schools that were pretty remote, meaning, you know, sort of not near a city. And
it was a very different kind of an environment for you.
Yeah. But I love college. As an athlete to start, and then as a fraternity brother, the latter 3 years, had a lot of friends. I enjoyed my college experience socially. But it was also the first time that I got in trouble with drugs and alcohol. It was probably the first time I used cocaine, hallucinogens, marijuana had been part of the picture in high school as well. Never regular use, but never.
So did it step up in college?
The day that I quit sports, I walked into the basement of my fraternity, and some would argue, my friends would tell you, he didn't leave for 3 years.
Sophomore year.
Yeah.
So that's when it started.
Yep.
And what was the reason you did that? Was it because you weren't doing sports, or you needed to feel some connection with a different group of people because you weren't on the team?
Both. Yeah. I think the lack of structure. I mean, you know, when I was a member of the team, I had one or two practices every day. I was traveling for meets. And so there was a lot of time. There was a big time commitment there. So there was a lot of time given back once I wasn't an athlete anymore. And also, yeah. So if I'm hanging out at the fraternity more, then I'm probably surrounding myself with other guys and girls who are there more. And we all have that same thrust or motivation, which is, you know, to have a good time and enjoy college. And so I didn't see anything wrong with it. It was just kind of the progression of the way things happened.
So second, third, last year of college, was it basically stable? Did it accelerate to some more terrible days at the end?
Yes, and both, okay. Right? So it accelerated, but I had career and life objectives that I still at that point were more important than drinking and using drugs. I had a place that I wanted to be. I had a vision for what my future looked like, and so I held it together. Graduated on time, and I went right to Wall Street. I had no particular skills or talent, so they said, "You Wall Street would be good for you." And I started right away, moved back to New York City.
Who said that? Wall Street would be good to
they, you. Yeah. Well, I saw a lot of my classmates older than me heading in that direction. My father had also worked on Wall Street for many years. I had been around trading desks, sales desks, research departments, and it seemed like something that would be fun. In fact, to back up, I remember as a 10-year-old visiting my father at his company, and he had a big office, but in the middle of the office, there was a big glassed-in room where there were guys that looked like they were having a ton of fun. They were yelling and screaming at each other, but smiling. They were, you know, on two phones at a time, punching keyboards, and I said, "Dad, who are those guys?" And he said, "Those are the traders." And I said, that's what I want to do.
Action.
Exactly.
Got it.
So that's where I ended up. Right onto a trading desk, trading bonds at first. My boss, he was also a Dartmouth alum and hired me on campus. And he said to me when I got there, "Trey, here's your corporate credit card, And here's a big book of accounts that trade our product. And here's the accounts that we already do business with. And you can have anyone else. Internationally, we traded U.S. Treasuries. So it was everybody, every financial institution in the world trades U.S. Treasuries. So I took his credit card and started, you know, figuring out, okay, so where would I like to go visit? Oh, maybe San Francisco would be a nice place to visit. I'll go call on some accounts in San Francisco. Or maybe Amsterdam would be a nice place to go. Who trades U.S. Treasuries in Amsterdam? So he gave me a lot of latitude, and I did a lot of business. I will say that in this time period, this now I'm 23 until I was 26, my drug and alcohol use ramped up because I was, you know, drinking with clients. I was sort of merging into that Wall Street milieu of work hard, play hard, and you know, entertaining clients. And what that meant was staying out late with them and building relationships with them through alcohol. You know, I was 26 years old. I woke up one morning down at my family's house, beach house in New Jersey, and I didn't know how I got there. It was a Wednesday morning, and it was the first time that I called into work sick, said I won't be in today. And my second call was to my dad, and I said, I got a problem, and I need to do something about it. I don't think I can be in New York City anymore. And he said, well, maybe you should move to San Francisco. You know, if you go to work out there, you'll have to be at work at 4 a.m. You'll be out of work at 1:00. And what he didn't say, but what I think he intuitively knew, was that there was much less of a drinking culture around Wall Street on the West Coast because of the hours. So long story short, within 6 months, I was in San Francisco.
For the same firm?
No, change firms. And I actually moved from fixed income to equities. Went to work for a company called Hambrecht & Quist. This is 1996. And Hambrecht & Quist was kind of at the epicenter of the first internet boom. We were doing lots of IPOs. We were a hot, hot firm. I was at work every day at 4 a.m. At the end of work, people were not rushing to bars. They were going for runs. They were playing golf. They were playing tennis. They were going sailing. So again, because I still had a big priority on, you know, my career, and I did all those things as well. And for a while, I didn't have a problem with drugs and alcohol. It's not that I was abstinent, but it wasn't a priority, and I wasn't drawn that way. So we hear in AA that geographics are just, you know, you taking yourself somewhere else, and you're going to get the same result. For me, it worked for a while. I was there for 6 years.
I've never heard that work.
Yeah, worked for me.
So your dad knew something.
Yeah.
And maybe at that point, you hadn't yet crossed the line entirely. You had a blackout warning shot, so to speak. So it got you back across the line for a little while. That makes sense?
Absolutely. No, I think that's a good way to put it. We've heard people, you know, tell their stories where they say, you know, I knew at 25 I was destined for treatment. I did not. I in fact didn't know anybody in AA. I didn't know really anything about rehab. I was learning that I used more drugs and alcohol than the average guy, but usually there was people right there with me, right? And usually it was a client or a coworker or a colleague. It wasn't like I was using by myself. That came, but it wasn't at that time. Moved back to New York in 2002, went back to work in New York City. Late 02, I went to the hospital with a serious stomach pain. By the way, at this point, I have a wife and two kids. My daughter was born in March of 2000. My son was born in November of 02.
You got married what year?
99.
Were you in San Francisco at the time?
Yep.
Met your wife in San Francisco.
Met her in New York before I went to San Francisco, and then she came out as well.
Okay.
So, yeah, Teddy was born in November of 02. In December of 02, he's like a month old. I have a terrible pain in my stomach. I don't know what's going on. I drive to the emergency room, and they tell me I need to have an emergency appendectomy. So they do that. I'm in the hospital for 3, 4, 5 days. It's the first time I'm given opiate pain medication. I've never had that before. And, you know, the nurse says, you can just press this button. I'll be right in with more. And I press the button a lot. And, you know, I it wasn't like a direct feed, but it was the nurse coming to, you know, give more. And, you know, I walked out of that hospital with a prescription for, you know, 60 pills, maybe two or three refills. So I had a runway of being able to use them. And I don't know what day it was when I realized I'm using these. I'm not in pain, but I'm using them. But it was, you know, within months of that happening. You know, to make a longer story shorter, I used opiates every day for 6 years after that surgery. And that was what took me to, you know, some pretty bad spots.
You were drinking during that time, but yeah. Mainly it was the opiates that brought you to your knees.
Yeah. I was using alcohol, cocaine, and opiates almost every day. So,
what year are we up to at this point?
02 to 08.
And you're in New York, relocated to New York.
I'm living in Connecticut now and okay. Working in the city. So I'm commuting in every day. And, you know, my opiate use is growing and growing and growing. I've got to go to different lengths to get them. And this is...
Were you doing it only because you were physically addicted to it, or were you also getting high from it?
50-50, right? There were days where I was just using to stay level. And there were days where, you know, I might be taking a few more. But I did realize that I had become physically dependent because I couldn't go a day without using them. And that was a scary realization. Having said that, I didn't do anything about it. The idea that, you know, I played the tape forward and said, well, if I go talk to someone about this, you know, I'm going to be in trouble because I'm buying these. I had progressed from doctor shopping to finding a supply, you know, that didn't include doctors. And so I knew intuitively it was wrong, but I also didn't want to stop. It got to the point where I was, you know, taking several hundred milligrams of opiates every day. And one morning I was asleep on the Metro North into the city, call it 6:30 in the morning, dozed off. And I had a vision of my daughter, who at that time was 8, Brooke. And in my vision, she was older, called early 20s. And she was telling a group of her friends that she never really got to know her dad because he had died at a young age. And I kind of came to and digested that and processed that. Didn't like that. And, you know, several weeks later, not months, but weeks later.
Not days either.
Right, not days either. My wife confronted me and said, you know, I don't know what's going on, but you need help.
Falling asleep at the dinner table?
You know, she found a big empty bottle of pills. And, yeah, I mean, my behavior had been poor, right? So I had always... again, under the umbrella of I'm career driven, I'm career focused, I'd be out late with clients and, you know, working on my career, which meant that I wasn't being the dad that I wanted to be or the husband that I wanted to be. And, you know, I just wasn't showing up for life or in all the areas that was important. Even some of my friends had kind of started to distance themselves.
So she confronts you 2008. And what happens as a result of that?
Well, she kicked me out of the house and said, you can't be here. And so I, the Friday night, got my car and I drove to New York City and I met my dealer. And then I continued my drive down to my dad's house in New Jersey, in Bayhead. And I must have arrived there at 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning. This would have been right around this time of year, June, late June, maybe even Father's Day weekend. I remember my dad came down the stairs at around 5:30-ish. He's an early riser. And I was on the porch outside, didn't want to bother anybody. Again, nobody knew I was coming. And he came outside and obviously knew something was wrong. I'm lying on a couch outside on the porch. And he opens the door to the porch and I said, Dad, I need help. And, you know, my dad's not a hugger. right? When like when we see each other, we shake hands. How you doing? It's firm. I look you in the eye, but hugging wasn't really part of the way we grew up. And he gave me a big hug and he said, everything's going to be okay. And at that time, at that exact moment, Corey, I felt off my right shoulder, I felt this warmth. And I kind of looked back and the sun was just coming up at that time. And I had this feeling that everything was going to be okay. I didn't know how, but that everything was going to be okay. So that would have been late June of 08. I'm 37 years old, wife and two kids, addicted to lots of drugs and alcohol. A week later, I went to treatment. And in that week, I had lots of different thoughts. None were like, I'm not going to go. It was just like, what is this going to be like? And what am I getting myself into? And I'm going to go, but I'm going to reserve the right to like make my own decisions, right? Because I'm so smart. And
What do they say? My best thinking got
me. Exactly. Yeah. I thought that was such a great line when I heard it the first time. I literally had a hospital administrator tell me that. She said, Trey, you can't leave here. And I said, listen, Janet, don't worry about it. I'm going to come back in a day or two. I live 10 minutes away. And she's like, you can't leave here. And I said, don't worry about it. And she said, Trey, take a look around, look where you are. And I kind of appeased her. And she said, you're a patient at a psychiatric hospital. That's the best you could do. I would suggest you listen to us for a little while, just a little while. And then you can make a decision. So I went to treatment, I went to detox, and then, you know, the residential program. And the two most important things that happened for me in treatment were, I was living in a house with 16 other guys that had the same problem as me, but they were good guys. I laughed with them. I enjoyed spending time with them. It felt like my fraternity in some ways. And I felt comforted by the common bond that we had of like, we all have this problem. And the second most important thing that happened was they took me to an AA meeting. I'd never been before. They drove us off campus into town, into New Canaan, and it was the first time I went to an AA meeting. There was 100 and some odd people in that AA meeting the first morning I went. I didn't know what to expect. I figured there's no way I know anybody here. Turns out I knew 3 or 4 guys immediately. And, like we were saying, I was really drawn in by the language, the vulnerability, the honesty that people were sharing was not anything I'd ever been experienced, and I was drawn to it. I was really thought it was neat. I thought it was really cool, and I was also very concerned that I was going to get brainwashed and join a cult, and I was going to make sure that didn't happen. So while I was interested and curious, I was also very arm's length.
Not hugging anybody.
Certainly not hugging anybody, but I saw other people hugging. I saw guys hugging. Hey, how are you? Good to see you. What's going on? How the kids? That was all interesting to me. And again, the stories that we heard and we continue to hear of recovery, the dark places that our addiction leads us, and then the recovery it was comforting to know that I wasn't alone. I was not alone, and I wasn't going to have to do this alone. And for me, as an extrovert, we've talked about teammates, we've talked about fraternities, we've talked about trading desks. Like, these are all teams. These are all big groups of people. That's where I like to be. I'm not a loner, right? I'm a people person.
So you get out of treatment, you connect with 12-step. How things go with your wife? Did you resolve things after going to treatment?
Yeah, so while I was in treatment, my wife invited me not to move home, and so I needed to figure out where I was going to live. And it didn't work out for us, and that was okay. It seemed like a catastrophe at the time. 2 young kids at home, divorce was something that both her parents and my parents and that we had gone through as kids, and we vowed that we would never do that to our kids, and obviously now here we are getting divorced. So that was disappointing and sad, but it was what it was, it was important for me because I went into AA that day when I got the papers and I said, my wife filed for divorce and I'm not sure why I'm going to stick around here. And I was met with a bunch of guys who said, that's actually the best reason to stick around here. And I let those guys kind of carry me for the next 3 months. I went to work and did what I was supposed to do. Stayed sober, but it was really just following those guys that I had met in AA. And, you know, when I raised my hand and say, I work in New York City, they said, you should go meet Donnie. You should go meet Mike. They go to a meeting on 46th Street. You should go meet this group. And if I say, I'm going to Florida, oh, you should go down to the Crossroads Club and, you know, go meet Billy. And when I was really amazed at this huge social network that I knew nothing about.
Right.
And that we're all kind of like, you know, guided and driven for good, right? It was really appealing to me. There's no dues, there's no fees, there's no expectations. Just come here. By the way, there's no rules. There's only a desire. You only have to have a desire to stop drinking. You don't even have to stop drinking. I would tell you, Corey, that when I left treatment 33 days sober, I would have told you that I'm done using drugs. I'd like to be done using drugs, but I can't imagine a life where I'm not drinking. They tell me they're connected. I'm not sure I believe that. This is what they're telling me in treatment. But I'll do whatever you tell me to do for 90 days. And it was in that time period, going to 150 AA meetings, call it, and meeting the most amazing guys, some of whom are my closest friends today, that in that time period, it was like my mind shifted to, I might not drink again. I'm not certainly not going to commit today for lifelong abstinence, but mm-hmm. I love how I'm feeling. I love this social network that I've been exposed to. Things are going okay in my life. By the way, it's fall of 2008, so it's also the financial crisis. I don't know if I'm going to have a job on a day-to-day basis. You know, big, big firms are going out of business, like Lehman Brothers, packing up shop. We're done. We're bankrupt. And so that was part of it. That was in my mind for sure. And when I got to 90 days, I was like, I'm not going to drink tomorrow. I'm going to keep doing this. And it may be hokey to say it's been a daily decision ever since, but in some ways it has, right? It's like anytime it hasn't happened often, but anytime that I've slacked off on my involvement in the 12-step community, something has brought me right back in.
The thing that keeps me coming back is that the reason that I liked the use was because I didn't like how I felt. I wanted to change how I felt. And today, I don't have that motivation anymore. And so I think it's not that I made a commitment that I'm getting coins.
Right.
It's that I feel fine without drinking or drugging. And I know how that movie ended last time. I don't really want to watch it again. You know, it's just kind of happens on its own, and you don't really get persuaded by anybody to do this. You kind of feel it yourself, and it becomes its own thing, you know? This is not so bad. Plus, you went through a divorce, you have little kids, that's like kind of traumatic, and you didn't pick up during that time, right?
Correct.
You had this community to connect with around you, and it was okay.
Not only okay, I felt great, right? Like I had a team again. I was feeling healthy physically, mentally, and I don't lead with it when I'm talking to people about AA, but like I was feeling like there was something out there that was guiding me, that was leading me, that like. That feeling that I had on my dad's porch, everything's going to be okay, it grew and got stronger. Like, not only is it going to be okay, it's going to be really good. And, but the deal, the trade is, like, you can't drink and use drugs, right?
Right.
And that, again, wasn't difficult, but it was, that was the deal.
You know, it's funny, as you're saying that, the deal is you can't drink and do drugs. That's kind of like saying, you know, you can't put the thumbtacks in your eyes. You know, okay, fine. Yeah. I won't put thumbtacks in my eyes.
Right, right, right. I learned so much in those early days in meetings, you know, so much that I identified with, so many slogans and sayings and just little tidbits that, you know, knocked knocked me across the face that today I hear regularly and go, that's a good one. You know, like my buddy Drew will say, like, if they told me that I couldn't eat broccoli, I wouldn't eat broccoli, right? It'd be no problem. So why would it be, why is it a problem if I can't drink alcohol or use cocaine, right? And in some ways, it's really simple. Now that I work in the field of addiction and recovery, I understand that it's not that simple. And for a lot of people, there's a lot of other reasons why it may not be simple. But I feel fortunate and blessed that for me, the desire to drink and use drugs was gone pretty quickly. And I, if the social network didn't exist, I'm not sure I would have continued on this path. But I mean, you're a good example. I meet most amazing people, the people that I like to hang out with, people that I'll call up and say, hey, let's grab a coffee. Let's go play golf. Let's grab, you know, let's go to the beach, whatever. It's, those are the people I want to hang out with. Right.
So, I gather that a lot has changed since 2008. You want to talk about a little bit of the things that are different in your life since this path came upon you? I mean, both in terms of your personal life, work life. You have a job, I assume.
Oh, man. My sponsor tells me he's pretty sure that, you know, God does not want me to win the lottery because it just wouldn't look good, you know. I'm not able to not work. So since 2008, I met an amazing woman in AA, was never going to get married again, didn't want to set myself up for, you know, disappointment and despair, and that all went out the window, so I met Kate, and we got married, and now we have three little kids, so I have five kids all together. Father's Day is the best. You know, we have this marriage that, that, you know, stems from recovery. It's this, you know, she's been sober since she was 21 and, you know, still has a sober network and goes to meetings and, you know, kind of knows the deal. We're on the same path and that's been fabulous.
Yesterday was Father's Day.
Right.
How had that?
Yeah.
How'd that look?
That looked like me and Kate and our three little ones driving down to Bayhead to see my dad and my brother and his kids. So we had maybe, you know, 13, 14 at the table, and just fabulous. Beautiful day, you know, three of my five kids. I got to talk to the other two, and I'm really blessed. Really, really, really blessed. In 2015... So 7 years sober, so in 2013, there a new company opened up here in New York City called Serenity, which was billed themselves as high-end sober living, and I was curious about it. I heard about it. I had some people that I knew that were going there after treatment. And it sounded, what they talked about was really great. It was like, hey, it's a beautiful condo or a beautiful loft. And, you know, there's you know, all the furnishings are, you know, top notch. There's a great chef, good people. We go to meetings together, but we're also going to work. And it sounded really intriguing to me. And I said, we should do that in Connecticut, in New Canaan or Darien or somewhere. And I kind of looked into what the rules and the laws would be and vis-a-vis zoning, and I realized that we could do it. And so in 2016, I left my career of 23 years on Wall Street and started a company called The Lighthouse, which was men's sober living, eight beds in Darien, and an 8,000 square foot home on 4 acres, you know, private chef, guys coming to live with us after treatment. You know, it was basically created the place I wish I had had to go when I was leaving treatment and wasn't invited home. And so that was 2016. It sounds crazy because, you know, it was never on my radar. I was not, you know, I had no interest in doing something like this. But what I saw was like, there, I think there's a pretty big need for this. I think there's a, you know, there had been places for young adults all the time to go because the parents said, you know, we don't really want them home. And so they go somewhere else. But there had never been a place set up for, you know, 45-year-old business guys, married, kids, or, and for women, you know, the thought was like, well, they'll just go home, or they'll just go to, you know, their second house or third house and figure it out. And so we started in Darien in 2016. We opened a women's house in 2020. Today we have two homes, both in New Canaan, you know, 10 beds men's, 8 beds women's. They're both, you know, 10,000 square foot homes on 5 acres. Beautiful, beautiful recovery homes. And our clients come to us usually after treatment, usually after a 30-day stay, although not all the time. And, you know, we've got this incredible 12-step community around us in Fairfield County. We've also just got just a beautiful place to live and be for a while. Our clients, you know, leave the house in the morning, go to work, go to meetings, go to the gym, go to see their families, whatever they, you know, are doing that day. But at the same time, they're, you know, they've got the accountability and the community that the Lighthouse provides for that next step of the journey. So that, you know, clients usually stay with us for 4, 5, 6 months. And then they roll into our next phase, which is they don't live with us. They move either home or wherever they're going next, but they stay connected to us and come back to the Lighthouse and for events, meetings, dinners, and just that becomes their community. And it's been, you know, it's been coming up on 9 years. And this was never anything that I thought about.
You know, I think you can trace the mission that you have and what you've been realizing with Lighthouse, both in the men's and the women's house, to your experience with fraternities and teams, and not to mention the connection you had with AA when you first came out of treatment and connected that. You had such a wonderful feeling of collegiality and you know, togetherness that came from those experiences. That's really what you've made your life is creating a I don't know what sport you were in. What sport?
Swimming.
Terrible
sport to be good at.
Right. Well, you know, it's not. You could pick worse ones. I mean, right. Curling is something. I don't really get curling at all.
Right.
When I did stand up, I had a whole routine about curling.
Broom.
Yeah, I'll tell you about that later on. But the thing is that the feeling you get when you're a part of something, the whole is much bigger than each one of us individually. I've been at the Lighthouse. I've spoken there. I think a Tuesday night is the gathering,
yep.
Especially in the nice weather out in the back. There's nothing like that. And you have men coming from all over to gather there. I mean, I'd say probably only a small number are the people that are actually living there at the time, but you have an incredible community connected. We've created really another tool in the toolbox of staying sober, an important one for people that are in that geographic location. People, you know, are there and they're open and they're honest and they're transparent about their lives and what they're going through. The great thing is when I went up to speak last summer at the Lighthouse, I saw people from the New Canaan meeting that I used to go to for about 3 years, and I couldn't believe it. It's like, you know, our community, that we're all connected. You always find somebody that you know or somebody that knows somebody. It's a really wonderful thing.
Yeah, Corey, I love the fellowship of AA and the fellowship of recovery even, right? I even like hanging out. I like people who have recovered and, you know, have had that dark spot and are now on the other side and are able to talk about it and maybe even help somebody else through their experience. You know, you coming up there is what we do, right? We believe that the best way, the easiest way for someone to go from early recovery into solid recovery is to surround themselves with people who have lives that they want theirs to look like. You know, stick with the winners, we heard in the rooms.
One of my guests, Stephen Hill, said something really funny. He said, you know, they, they tell you not to take everybody else's inventory, right? And then they say stick with the winners.
Right, right.
What the hell is that?
Yeah.
I didn't originate that, but it's funny. And there are other kind of things that you see, but most of it makes sense.
The best part about my life today is the fact that, you know, I whip out my phone and, you know, if I'm going to San Francisco in a few weeks, I'll text Dave, I'll text Zeke, I'll text, you know, my buddies that are out there. Hey, what's going on? Are you going to be at the meeting on Tuesday night? If I'm going to, you know, Florida or Texas or Boston, or, you know, I have groups there of buddies that I'm excited to go see. And that is something, I don't know of another network like that. You know, it's pretty special. So at the Lighthouse, guys come and women come and they get connected to a recovery community. They heal. I mean, you and I both know that, like, there's, you feel a lot different at 90 days sober than you do at 10 days sober or 30 days sober or 40. So, you know, part of the process is just healing and taking time and being in a safe environment. But at the same time, the problem with treatment is that you don't get to practice those tools. When you're in treatment and you're in a residential place, you don't get to, like, go out to the restaurant and see if you can not drink. Our clients every day are testing their recovery, and they feel really good about it. When you put your head down at the end of a day and you went to work and saw your kids and went to the gym and whatever you did, you didn't drink, and that's a big win. You know, early on, that's a big win. It's why we count days early on.
When people leave treatment, I know the feeling I had, and I've talked to plenty of people that are about to leave. You know, what I like to remind people is that when you put your foot on the ground, the gravity is still there.
Right.
The air is still there. It's not all that different. But I ask people, how did you feel when you walked in? And the typical answer is, I was very frightened. I was scared. I didn't know why I was here. I didn't know how I got here. And I don't know what's going to happen here. I don't know why, what happened to me. And I say, how do you feel now, when they're about to leave? They say, oh, I feel a lot better. I'm at the gym and I'm walking again. And I feel more like myself. That's what recovery is. It's exactly what happens. So when you leave there, and if you're going to a step down type of thing, like, for instance, the Lighthouse, get another chunk. And then before you know it, everything is different. You don't exactly know when that happened.
How it happened.
But you just got to give it time, and things do change. But it's, you know, not in our time. We are very impatient people by, our constitutions. And if we give ourselves enough time to heal, things just start changing.
And our client, too, our typical client, Corey, because they're older, they usually can point to lots of professional successes along the way that would indicate to them that they are successful and able to make their own good decisions. And that can be a real hindrance from time to time, you know, not taking advice, not taking suggestions. You know, I remember, it reminds me of early on, like, again, I was sure, I wanted to make sure I wasn't going to be brainwashed. Like, I wasn't going to do anything that didn't make sense to me. The best thing for me about early days in AA was that no one ever came up to me and said, you have to do this and you have to do that. They all just said, if you want what we have, I'll give you the playbook, right? And everyone's playbook's a little bit different. If I thought that your recovery was attractive, I could say, Corey, what do you do in this scenario? If I thought that Mike's playbook was not attractive, I wouldn't ask Mike any questions. And that was the best thing about AA. What doesn't work is to be completely closed-minded and to say, I'm going to figure this out myself. Or, you know, I'm just going to keep... I know that because I've been successful in other areas of my life, I can be successful in recovery. I'll figure it out. Rarely do we see that work, right?
Right.
You got to follow the... Follow the lead.
Yeah, they make suggestions, and you take what you like, and you leave the rest. And when I was in treatment in 1982, my first foray into treatment, a little guy named Philip Rowland told me, trying to do this yourself is like trying to wash blood off of your hands with blood.
Right.
It doesn't work. You need other people to connect with and do it. And you're, aside from your own recovery and your own ability to put yourself into the mix and become a part of the community. You're doing that for all these other people, and it's got to make you feel good, because, you know, what's that 12th step? Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to other alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, there you go. We have Trey Laird doing that every day, one day at a time.
Thank you, Cor. It's not the life that I envisioned for myself at 53 years old. This is not where I thought I would be. But it is exactly where I'm supposed to be. And I wake up every morning like pretty freaking excited. You know, it's an amazing life. It's an incredible opportunity. And I thank the person upstairs who's been moving the pieces around the chessboard that landed me here.
Right? She's amazing.
Exactly.
So we usually ask each guest the following question. If you had the opportunity to speak to little Trey, I don't know, pick the age, 8, 10, 12, whatever, and you had any advice you were going to give little Trey right now, knowing everything that you know about how things go in life, what advice would you give the younger version of yourself?
You know, simply, it's all going to be okay. It's all going to work out. You know, everything, God has your back.
A little bit like your dad's advice to you, that on the porch. Interesting.
Interesting, right? Yeah. I heard early on somebody say, everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be today, and if it was supposed to be different, it would be. And I kind of ran that around in my head to see if I could poke a hole in it, or if there was a reason why that statement wasn't a fact. And once I realized that there wasn't, that was the fact, that made me very comfortable that everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be today. And if it was supposed to be different, it would be. Everything's going to be okay. The only thing I control is my actions and my attitude. That's the only thing I control.
You know, that's the word I was thinking about when you were talking, is control. If you let go, so much easier.
So much easier.
And it's hard to do, because that's not what we're taught.
No.
We're taught to, like, you know, you can do this.
Game plan, you know, strategize. I'm going to do this, and then this is going to happen. Then I'm going to move over here. I'm going to get this job. I'm going to meet this, you know, like.
Winners and losers.
Yeah.
Where do you want to be, son?
Right. Oh, man. Well, I don't know if there was an answer in there, but I figure you'll find something.
There's an answer in there, and the answer is that we're both winners. We're both sober.
I'm happy to call you a friend. I'm happy to, you know, be on this journey together.
Same. Thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure.